What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to another episode of Black Seinfeld. In case you have not known by now, this is a show about absolutely nothing, nothing at all. I go by the name of Psyche.
I go by Bashanissa.
And we just want to thank you guys once again for tuning in. This is 99.5 FM WBAI. This is Free Speech Radio. How you doing, bro?
I'm doing absolutely well. How are you?
I'm doing well. I have an interview today.
Of course. It's not snowing today.
It's not snowing today, so that's a good thing. It is actually spring.
Yeah.
It's going to be 50 degrees today.
Allegedly spring.
Allegedly. I mean, it was spring when Obama was president.
Oh, yeah. It was spring early when Obama was president.
It really was.
8 years in a row.
Yeah. We had a lot of record-breaking temperatures when Obama was president. But now, you know, that 45's in, things are looking a bit stormy.
Yeah.
No? Yeah. No pun intended.
Yeah, that was great. That was perfect.
Did you see the 60-minute interview?
No, I have not.
Why?
First of all, I was working. By the time I got home, 60 minutes was over. 60 minutes starts at 7 o'clock. So I got home like 8, 10, and that's it.
They recorded the whole thing on YouTube, by the way.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to look into it. I'm just going to listen to or read summaries of. And it was nothing like spicy, you know. It wasn't that juicy.
Oh, there was some spicy stuff.
No, it was just like it's spicy.
We were talking about it in the conference room.
Yeah, it's spicy in the sense of hey, let's talk about it. But it's like I need some impeach. You know what I mean? I need some impeachment words. That's what I need. And it's gonna pass through.
You don't think the whole affair is impeachment worthy?
No.
What do you think is gonna be impeachment worthy?
He has to kill a man in the White House with security watching, and someone's like, I can't let this go. I have to snitch.
Kevin Spacey did that.
Yeah, yeah.
But in that
Where
scene,
is he now?
It was a train. Oh, he is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. House of Cards, final season. I think Claire's
right.
The president.
Yeah.
I
think I'm right. So that's the only way he could get knocked out. He has to do something in the now.
Mm.
And it will happen eventually. He's a clumsy person.
What if he buys the new Wu-Tang? That's available now. That's in the hands of Jess.
Well,
Sessions,
he is from New York,
allegedly.
And he does know who Wu-Tang is.
I mean, he's from your neighborhood. He's from Queens.
I'm from Kew Gardens, Queens. Shout out to Kew Gardens.
He's from Jamaica.
What? Yeah. Oh, no. He's on the Jamaica East State.
No. I don't care, man. I don't care about
I'm not from that side either.
I know, but I'm saying he's from Jamaica. That's all.
All right.
Today is a special day because we back with having guests. Bashan.
Yeah.
Dang. Oh, you want me to do the introduction?
Yeah.
I thought you fine then. All right, my bad. We have comedian, storyteller, podcaster, homie, gangster, East New York in the building, Brooklyn, stand up. Give it up for the homie, Mr. Gastor El Monte, ladies and gentlemen. Gastor.
What's good, y'all?
You've been laughing a lot.
I've been a little disgusted and I was real like entertained and then disgusted by the Queens aspect of it, but
he really is, man.
You know?
I'm past his house, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, going to one of my homies' crib. It's like, wait a minute. This house looked very familiar. Let me Google it. It's like, yeah, this is the
Your
house.
Spider senses was tingling automatically.
Yeah.
You just knew something was wrong.
Because there's an article that kind of came up a while ago. It's like, I know this neighborhood. And I know this is the house.
You know how in horror movies you can just tell a house is just, you shouldn't just go in a house.
It's a nice house.
Nah.
I would go in this house. I would buy the house.
But no, see, in horror movies, there's a lot of nice houses, though. But yeah. When you go in, you know, there's something about the energy and the aura that's a little bit, you know what I mean? You wouldn't want to go in the house. Think about Chris from Get Out. That house was lovely. That house was beautiful.
Yeah.
But there was something wrong with that house.
Yeah, he didn't really have to burn it. He could have flipped it.
Look how far Queens real estate has fallen in entertainment. Like, we are now recognizing Trump's childhood home. I remember recognizing the house from Belly in Jamaica Estates. That made me happy. You know, that was a good Queens moment for y'all. How the mighty have fallen.
Yeah.
I feel for y'all, man.
I do, too.
It's not bad. We out here. We bigger than both of y'all. Anyways.
What? No, you're not.
The borough.
Sorry, bro.
The borough.
Definitely not.
Sorry, man.
Queens has incredible neighborhoods, but it has so many average neighborhoods.
Yeah, there's more average than anything special.
Man, we got Brownsville and East New York in the building, man. Yeah. Watch how you talking to us, man. Relax, B. Hey, Mike is in the building. Intern Mike just stepped in. Mike, how you doing, bro? You good?
Good. Tired.
What have you been up to, man?
Oh, I just came from the march. Went to D.C.
Oh, dang.
Damn.
What was that like?
It was lit.
You gonna let him scream from across the room?
Yeah, I'm gonna let him scream from across. You wanna come on mic real quick before we get the interview going?
Mic going on mic.
It was lit. Went to the march. It was pretty fun.
You saw Martin Luther King's granddaughter?
Yes. That was crazy. She was just so intelligent, so smart. Then I seen a kid from Brooklyn. It was amazing.
You just gave the most "it was lit" in history. Like, that was so professional sounding.
You know, that's what you got to do, man. We on BAI, man.
I've never seen "it was lit" used as an official statement before. Like, he cleared his throat to say that. You heard that?
That's the most East New York thing you can ever do.
Yo, he from East too, right?
My man, hell yeah. That's what's up. Pennsylvania Avenue. My man, Pickin Ave right here, bro.
Word, you from Pickin?
Yes, indeed, man.
Okay.
Actually still own that building.
My guy. You know, Pickin Avenue is really huge. Pickin Avenue, to me, would be the equivalent of what Jamaica Ave is right now. That's what I think of Pickin.
It's a beautiful place, man. It's changing, though, but it's
changing in the bad way?
Depends on if you like Starbucks. You know, it's really
bad. It happened at the Ave too, man.
Yeah, it's gonna happen there. It's coming around.
Chipotle, the whole nine.
Yeah.
So let's get into the interview, man. So obviously we said it already, you're from East New York. What is some of the misconceptions about living in the hood that people may have? Because right now East New York is one of the worst places to live in the city right now. So what are some misconceptions that people may have?
Sure. Like, there's levels of danger, essentially, when you're in the hood. Like, there's this misconception because of, like, movies in the 90s that, like, you're just constantly seeing robberies. Like, you can't walk outside without getting jacked. That's just not the case. It's just the amount of things that go wrong happen to be reported better there. And on top of that, criminals, I think, are a lot smarter than what they're depicting on TV. People ain't just jacking you in front of cops and other people, other citizens. It's just reckless. I feel that there is a real, real hood Ocean's 11 taking place somewhere in East New York and Brownsville that just hasn't been reported or made into a movie yet. So I feel like there's not enough credit given to hood criminals. They're far more intelligent. They show a ton of restraint. It's been about 20 years since somebody's, like, phone's been jacked on the train. Like, I don't hear anywhere near enough iPhone robberies by comparison to the sneaker robberies that I grew up with. When you consider the prices, like, 10 to 1. You know, like, sneakers was like $1.25 back then, and everyone was going home shoeless. Whereas people just casually take selfies on a J train with $1,000 cell phone. So I feel like that shows a level of restraint. Like, all right, there's 100 people on this train. Let me not jack this person.
But shoes don't have tracers.
But see,
true.
But here's the thing now. Being from Brooklyn, though, the new trend is scamming. That's the new trend.
Yeah.
And now people have getting a bit more intricate in the scamming. I encountered a scammer not too long ago. He was dressed nicely. I was at the Five Guys, of course. His car didn't work, and I made him, like, he's from Brooklyn. I could tell. Once the car didn't work and he wanted to step out to call his bank, I'm like, he's from Brooklyn. Then immediately afterwards, his girl followed. It's like, yeah, they try to get him. They try to get us.
I think they come in, too. That's how I feel like scammers come in, too. Like, one person like, nah, you don't really need it. And the other person's like, yo, swipe the card again. So that's how you know this person.
There was a girl from Brooklyn that got arrested because she took a little under $400,000 from UP from Home Depot's with a credit card scam. Like, she convinced them. She was calling all the Home Depot's in New York and New Jersey, claiming to be a Home Depot rep from the corporate office and doing a test on how they process gift cards. Mm-hmm. And she G'd like something like 1,000 different cashiers. Because they had just switched over to PayPal and they didn't understand how to use the system. And she knew PayPal well from her eBay hustling and scamming people from that. So she was regularly scamming people on how to go through the PayPal process by giving her a gift card with money that didn't exist. And then she would just spend it before they could figure it out.
Did the FBI hire her?
I'm just impressed. I feel like that's a dope hustle.
I feel like criminals don't get enough credit, man, because if you find a way to crack the system, you have to be rewarded for, like, working with the government or something. That's how it used to go in movies.
It's important to – it's like investing in stock. You have to know where it's, like, what you're aiming for.
Right.
So, like, you can't continue going.
Like, you understand? What's your end game?
Yeah, what's your end game? Like, make it early so you won't get in trouble.
But I respect her because she was legit buying stuff that you can build a house with. Like, she was actually getting equity itself. Like, all she needed was just the space. Okay. Like, if she just bought a vacant lot, she had $400,000 in freaking Home Depot supplies. Like, that's, you can legit buy a house.
That's crazy.
By pieces, you'd be buying it by 2x4s, but you can. I'm impressed.
I am too, man.
No, I'm impressed too. I'm just saying, like, you're supposed to have a limit in order not to get caught.
And to your point, like, I feel like if this was like what's the Leonardo DiCaprio's character in
Catch Me If You Can?
Yeah, like, he does something wrong, he gets caught, he gets a career out of it.
That is true.
We don't get those options.
I mean,
now you gotta be nice at it. You gotta be the best of the best at the time. You were the best at the time, though.
400K, though,
that's
man.
That's the best of the best.
And think about it. She scammed people into thinking that she was a part of the Home Depot rep. You know how much of a nice voice you have to be? Like, hello, this is Susan from Home Depot Corporation.
Yeah, also you need to get the names right and the area. So
thank
it's my research.
And it's like, you know, like when people say, like, anybody could drop 50, like Tony Delk did the 50-point game one day, you know, Jamal Crawford. But Jordan gets credit for doing 30 consistently. Mm. She didn't do a 400K robbery. She did thousands of little robberies that added up to 400K. That's the Jordan of that hustle.
Yeah, actually now I'm looking at it, it's like,
they need to hire her.
Yeah, like, she needs a gig.
How much she got, do you know?
It was just under $400,000.
No, I mean time.
Oh, nah. I just want to hear the inspirational parts of those stories.
True,
you know?
Fair enough. So I'm curious because, you know, I was born in the early 90s, but I was still a baby.
Okay.
So I have an older brother, and he's like 10 years old. He's 10 years older than me. And he would always talk about Brooklyn in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
And how wild it was. So please, can you give me a perspective of East New York in the 90s.
Sure. You actually have a real good perspective of it because of where you are. Essentially, like, there was a time when Brownsville, which is still an incredibly, like, awesome and authentic Brooklyn neighborhood, and even that's gotten a little bit, like, softer by comparison to what it was in the 90s.
A little bit.
But it still maintained a lot of its essence of what made it dope. And essentially what made East New York dope and what made Brooklyn dope is that it was all that everywhere. Even if we had, like, our own little, like, intricacies per neighborhood, but it was that everywhere. And he wasn't even, like, a black, a brown, or whatever thing, because you had, like, Italian neighborhoods that was like that, too. But essentially, it was, like, people just, like, really getting by, and in turn, some people did it legit, some people didn't, but there was a respect aspect of it for doing it. Whereas, right now, I would say 20 of the 25, like, neighborhoods are people that came from elsewhere, and not even, like, other boroughs, like, other states, and they don't have that grit that's associated with New York at all. And that kind of translates to the neighborhood not being genuine, you know, and it doesn't feel like New York anymore. So, yeah, we don't get those fun stories anymore. And unfortunately, you know, the food suffers, you know, because you need struggle to have good food. And
that is
I
true.
Feel like that's hurting us, you know.
I agree with you right there. So when you were 13, your dad was like, hey, you know what, son, it's a good idea if you go to prep school.
Yeah.
What was that like being a kid from the 90s, early 2000s? You know, some people thought back then that intelligence wasn't cool. And here you are from East New York going to a prep school.
Yeah.
So did you feel any type of way of like, man, they're gonna discredit my street cred if I wear cargo pants?
Nah, I hated it completely.
Like, you did?
Yeah. My dad, he still is a super street dude. I would say he is currently like 80% legit now. And that's like with effort, you know? Like, he's like made like every single like concession to try to get to that point. And he had aspirations of his kids not having any of that. So he made a ton of effort to shield me from it and to make sure I wasn't around that. And he took pride in that. Whereas I thought it was dope that he was doing all that and I couldn't because he just wouldn't let me. Like, even to this day, there's people that call me like Leo's kid. Mm-hmm. In the neighborhood. So, yeah, he did a real good job of making sure that certain options weren't open to me. And in turn, I ended up seeing it, being around it, but not being able to take part in it. Mm. Yeah, man. So I miss all that.
Did the white kids say the N-word around you when you were blasting rap music or nah?
Depends on how much drinking was involved. But yes, there was definitely... am I allowed to say this
around
a
you?
Lot. Like, there was my boy Adam, he was on a football team with me. And I remember we were at a party freshman year. And it was, I want to say it was like the Puff song with Big and Busta Rhymes on the hook.
Victory?
Yeah. Mm. So, you know, Busta goes ape with that word during the hook. So he looks at me, says it. And, like, I legit just gave him, like, a shoulder tap. I was like, nah, dude. Nah. Like, I didn't even explain it further. It was just like, listen, that's just not cool. ever again. And we talk about that often, like regularly. He like looks at me. He's like, "Yeah, so I don't understand, but I appreciate that you like took the time out to do that with care." Because like I looked at him like with concern, you know, like he's like, "Yo, listen, B, you've come far, but you can never go there," you know. And he needed to know.
He's
you
like,
know?
"I like you, but
you can't.
You can't cross that bridge.
You can't." And it's cute, you know, to see the approval. There's also like a. There's also an effect of that happening when there's a lot of them. Like, if it's two or three, they'll look at me for approval. If there's like 100-to-1 ratio, they'll do it.
Of course.
And look at you like daring you to check it. And it's an awkward moment there, too, because then it tests your blackness. Like,
right.
Hold on. Like, you know, like, am I going to just let this slide even though I'm going to def, like, get jumped if I check it too hard, you know? So it's an awkward moment. I've been to those parties, too.
Explain, like, the culture shock when you first got into prep school because, you know, New York is so diverse with cultures and stuff. So being a kid from the hood going to this nice, affluent area, can you describe some of the culture shocks that you went through?
Oh, yeah, for sure. There's a few subtle differences. One, when I grew up in Eastern New York, there were nice cars. But there was a nice car for, like, the dealer and, like, one or two people that, like, owned property might have, like, a pretty good sedan. Whereas when I went to prep school, everyone had fly cars. Like, if you were the freshman and you had, like, an older sibling and your parents. Like, I've seen parent-teacher conferences where I knew a kid was in trouble because you'd see, like, 4 BMWs in a row. And they were, like, in size order. Like, the kid would have the 3 Series. His older brother, who was a senior, would have, like, a 5. The mom would have a 5. And the dad would have a 7. And it was just, like, automatic. Like, these are just the whips. For prom, I got invited to prom by the chick that freaking, her dad was, like, up there with, like, the Levi company. Wow. So, like, my whole joint was set up through them. The level of money that was available was real different, too. And it skews what you think is realistic and what isn't. And it makes you aware about a lot of the things that, like, parents do different to us. But essentially, I became very aware of the fact that we're raised in a way that lets us think that nothing is ours, even by, like, our own parents. Like, they tell you not to move, sit still, chill on a train. And then, like, these kids were almost always given permission to explore because everything was theirs. And they've grown up to that. So, yeah, I think there's benefits to being around it as early as possible because they start to view you as one of theirs in a way. Mm-hmm. And it gets you connects in places that, as a 25-year-old, you shouldn't have because you're not from that world normally, but they grew up with you and they kind of see you. I don't think it's a coincidence that, like, Puff leveraged a lot of those things from his prep school days. There's a ton of those dudes that, like, because they were the man in those environments, they got connects that wouldn't normally be accessible to us.
Interesting. Was it, like, a Catholic school or just was
a Catholic school. I went to St. Francis Prep in Fresh Meadows.
Oh, that one.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, great school. I learned a lot. The standards are higher. Like, passing there is a 75. So it's like a minimal thing, but it's just like an expectation of that. And mind you, this is like a mid-level, like, prep school. There's prep schools that are like 30, 40K, mm-hmm, that are substantially, like, more restrictive to get into. But just being in those environments, I think, changes what you expect of yourself. And it opens you up to the huge differences. Like, I would be in that world and then take the Q30 to the J back to East New York. And it was just like, yo, this is wild.
You see the difference.
Yeah. Like, one of the things that I became aware of, like, when I was 18, I got a job at UPS, right? And I was doing blue-collar work. And I didn't realize that, like, because you're a certain level of intelligence as a person, you end up filtering out people that just aren't anywhere near your IQ, right? Like, if you're, like, 120 IQ, I'd guarantee most of your friends are anywhere from 110 to 130 because you'd find convo below that boring, right? And I worked in this place where I dealt with people that had 100 IQ, you know? And it's fine. You know, you get used to, you learn to communicate differently. And it's a necessity where we're from because those people have the same opportunities as people with 130 IQ just because we're poor in this neighborhood. Whereas at the prep school, they literally filtered it out because they had money. So, like, at that school, I dealt with no one below 120 that was of color at all. No one, because they wouldn't have made through all the cracks to get in there. But I definitely found, like, some, like, white folk that kind of got through some of those barriers because daddy had enough bread. You know, and it was just interesting to see that. So, like, those filters take place, and we naturally do it for friendship, but we're forced into more situations where that range is there and it's visible because we have no other place. You know, like, I'm surprised at the level of smart folks I found loading trailers.
Yeah.
You know? But you won't see that from people that went to that environment normally.
That is very true.
Oh, that's very interesting that you brought up prep school, because when I went, I didn't get that same experience.
Really? Where'd you go?
I went to, like, Holy Family School.
Okay.
Yeah, which is, it's in Queens.
Yeah.
And my experience for that, it was a bit, like, from what I remember from memory, it wasn't much compared to when I went to public school. And I got that experience from what you explained, from what you got from prep school.
Yeah.
So I think that public school has gotten better since then.
That's awesome.
So I think that's kind of interesting. So comparing school from public school back then to now, what's your thoughts on that?
I'm more on board with what you're saying now. I definitely noticed the quality change, not necessarily in all of public schools, but I found that there are more, there is better schools that are accessible to more people now.
Yeah, because my high school experience was terrible, so I won't compare it to that. But elementary school, it was something different.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me.
I'm in awe of my kids in elementary school now, and I'm very impressed with the school system. By the same token, the first 2 years, they went to the same public school I went to, and it's still terrible.
Okay.
You know, so I was like, yeah, this is still bad. This is still in East New York. And I was like, I can't do this. So I moved like a block over just to kind of allow them to be zoned differently.
Which public school in East New York?
Oh, you want me to trash my school now?
Nah, you got 273, 306.
I went to PS345.
Okay, I know where that's at.
Yeah. So now I can't go back there as like a featured like graduate because of you.
I know that school. I had a couple friends that went to that school.
There you go, you know.
I went to 346.
Okay.
Yeah, on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah, so I went there. It was cool, and I remember not thinking anything of it as a kid.
Right.
But I felt like I did very little, and they, like, automatically, like, I did well there with very little effort. But more importantly, there wasn't enough available to kind of accentuate that, whereas I felt like with the same skill set, if I was, like, a white kid in Whitestone, they would have put me in some incentive program.
Absolutely.
You know, and they would have filtered it out to make sure that all these kids have all the best options. Whereas there's a ton of just thankfully my parents had enough money to put me in certain situations. Yeah. But there's a ton of kids that grew up that are super sharp that they just had no other option. Like, you're just going to go to school with everyone. And this is just it. You know?
Yeah, I do believe the thing. If someone's smart or they're putting little effort whatsoever in school and they're getting high grades like 80s and 90s. And by the time they get to college, everything's so difficult for them.
Right.
So that's a big contrast in, like, today's public school, especially in, like, high schools. They don't really help you anywhere.
Right.
So, like, the prep school, they helped you get ready for university?
For sure. It was a big focus in the school. They had, I think it was, like, 99% of the graduates go on to college that year. I know my sister's there now, and she said that the current class is 100%. All in school with something like 70 with partial scholarships.
Okay.
So it's an expectation, just like little things that like the public school does, but they do at a certain level. Like, you know, the counselors are far more available after school activities. Prep had 140 different activities or clubs, like just stuff like that. That's just it's nuts, you know, that those type of things and those options to develop are available that we just don't have. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So when I see that, like, I'm hyped because I got to take advantage of it, and I appreciate that my parents, you know, made that happen. By the same token, that should just be the norm, you know?
Yeah.
That just should be how we treat kids, you know?
Everybody should get the equal opportunity, no matter where they live.
That's true.
Right. Yeah.
I feel like as an adult now, you realize the stuff that you didn't have as a kid, because as a kid, I really didn't understand that my school sucked or I lived in a terrible neighborhood.
Right.
I just thought it was a regular neighborhood. Sure, things happened, but I just thought it was normal.
Yeah.
And that's crazy looking at it now, that the stuff that we go through is not normal at all.
Yeah.
Like, gunshots is regular to me. Like, if there's no ambulance going by, I don't feel comfortable. That's just weird that we're in that position. Don't you think?
What trips me out about it is that, like, I don't think it changes your intelligence. You're still going to be smart, right?
Right.
Clearly, you're still here. What changes is the way it affects the way you critically think. And that's what I think is the issue. Like, I feel like high school and college, I don't really care what you study, but I care about how you learn to think and process information. And when you're brought up in an environment that for 12 years told you, yeah, you know, just do what you can, but we're not really going to try that much, you kind of learn to think, okay. You don't learn to critically process information. So when something real hits you, you can't handle it because you're not built to process a certain level of discomfort anymore. You were never taught it. Mm-hmm. When in an ideal situation, if you were of that level of intelligence, you should be the person we lean on because we've been developing you like a fine tool because we've put you in environments that tested your ability to do that. You know, like, okay, this guy has 130, 140 IQ. He's crushing it in a school. Put him in a better school. It'll test you more for sure. But when you're 30, that person might be a politician in our neighborhood instead of just like a pissed off UPS driver. You know, like still smart. We still need you, but it's not the same level. We didn't get to the potential that we needed out of you.
That's interesting. That's an interesting concept. Sorry for the silence. I'm just thinking about like,
hey, nah, I dig it. So this is what happens in my head all the time. Right, and this is the stuff that bothers me. And then this is what I talk about on stage. And that's essentially what people ask me, like when I'm being funny on stage, it's just me talking about stuff that frustrates me.
Right.
So like that's really it. Like I just find things that I find are weird or odd or disappointing, and then I just talk about it loudly, and people realize, right. Oh, I feel that way too, and that we share a laugh over it.
I feel like when it comes to comedy, especially like black humor, it always derives from like pain.
Yeah.
Or some sort of discomfort. Like, to me, an ass whooping is always going to be funny. Like, a good ass whooping story is going to be the best story ever.
For sure.
I remember I wanted to talk about the story because I did stand up low key about the time I hung myself and my mom whooped my ass because of it.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah.
That's how it should be, though. Those are the, because that's what we wanna laugh about. Like, I feel like the best stand up tells you about moments that like shaped you, and because of that, people find their moments and they relate to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Cool. Like, yeah. I was gonna say, like, you travel a lot, right?
Yeah.
And when you're in different regions, do you realize like some jokes just didn't hit because their culture is slightly different?
Huge. Yeah. From little things to like big aspects of it, like the when I was on Comedy Central's taping 2 years ago, like one of the first things I talk about is Snapple.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a big thing in New York. Absolutely. Whereas it's everywhere, but it's not as culturally like significant everywhere.
Shout out to Mango Madness.
Yeah, for sure. So like literally, like I'm in Cali and it occurs to me, I'm out there like 4 days and I've been to like a couple of corner stores and I haven't seen it. So I'm like, yo, I'm about to do a taping in front of a Cali crowd, and I don't even know if they're going to understand what the Snapple reference. Is. Yeah. So, like, I was asking, like, a whole bunch of, like, local people at the hotel if they knew it, and I finally felt comfortable enough doing it. But, yeah, like, stuff like that comes up, and that's just on a small scale. Then to your point, like, a bigger scale. Like, they might not get a joke or a reference. They might disagree with it so strongly that you're not only not going to get a laugh, you might get a exit. Like, okay. People might leave the room depending on what you say. So there's always a constant balance of that. And as comics, you'll find two school of thoughts. You'll find people that say, I'm supposed to say that anyway, and challenge the audience and risk people leaving because I got to say my truth. And there's other people that say, my job as a comic, regardless of where I am, is to entertain. So if I know going in this isn't going to work here, I should have more than just these jokes, and I should have other jokes that'll work for them. And it's always fascinating to see who falls under what barometer, because I don't think either one is wrong. Okay. It's just that, you know, that's what that comic believes in. That's their philosophy. Like, I don't think Chappelle will go into any room and hold back what he says. He feels what he feels, and he's willing to risk the audience leaving completely.
Yeah, like the uncut, like the fourth one that came out on Netflix.
Yeah.
That right there was
him. Bird Revelation.
Straight off, yeah, it was straight off the dome.
It was like a TED Talk.
Yeah.
And he fully, like, he went so in on that convo. It was like, yo, I'm fully accepting that all 300 of y'all might just get up and leave. And he's earned the right to do that, mind you. Most comics haven't. So there's even a bigger risk with that. But that's like a debate that you have as a comic every time you do a show like that. So, yeah, and he clearly has the option. He could do a 30-minute talk on anything. But he said, nah, I'm going to speak my truth, and I'm going to risk people leaving. And that's commendable. And then there's the other people that it's equally commendable. I can't do this here, so I'm going to do a whole other 30 minutes that I'm not normally going to do because I'm going to make any room laugh. You know, and that's also dope to me, you know?
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to be right back. This is the half-hour mark.
All right.
And you know, we wanted you to pick song of the week. You wanted Blasi Blasi, but I couldn't find a clean version. So the next best option for you was Thief's Theme by Nas. So we'll be right back. This is Black Seinfeld. Show About Nothing. Gastor El Monte. We back.
Let's get it.
1, 2. Check 1, 2, 1, 2. Who got more style than Sundu? Check 1, 2. Yo, I'm hot like 95 Fahrenheit on a summer night, tight spot where bitches ride. Rats drink from water drops in the streets. Little kids get cops with red dots. Philosophical gangster with violent priors. Going back like black and white TVs with pliers. Leaning on broke down cars with flat tires. Flash on anybody trying on the blocks. I'm Almighty Kong, my peeps, top balloons up and swallow them in the penal. Got goons, lots of them, cops see them and run, don't want no drama. Certain parts of the streets, the beast don't want a part of martyr, hood haunted like the Dakota, where John Lennon was shot up. But he sang for peace, he banged for freedom. Hang with wild Jamaicans from Kingston who drank Irish Moss, listening to Peter Winston McIntosh. Lightning hits the top of the church steeple when I'm writing. No hyphen, it's frightening. The Thief's Theme, play me at night, they won't act right. Understandable, smooth, then move with. The Thief's Theme, play me at night, they won't act right. Understandable, smooth, then move with. The Thief's Theme, play me at night, they won't act right. Understandable, smooth, then move with. The Thief's Theme, play me at night, they won't act right. Understandable, smooth, then move with. I take summers off, cause I love winter beef. Started 87 with the and the sheep. Three-quarter length beige, dressed to kill. At the ground, did the crowd, nobody like a stitch, everybody shut their mouth, Woolrich, Carhartt, the stains, smelling like on the brain, scheming on your girl's bamboos on your chain, got ill up on the train, twisting off a cap of the English in my vein, might have pushed you on the tracks, deaf crack fiends who can't speak, scream noises, cause she bought a jummer from one of my boys, it's just another day in the hood, and I'm with some wild brothers up to no good. We saw the movies like Tony Montana and them, but our style was lit them pals and we them money dudes. Make them come up out their shoes, run their jewels. Word is bonds while my man Nino gone, and I had to make a song speaking on my old life for the thieves who come out at night. The Thief's Theme, play me at night, they won't act right. Understandable, smooth, then move with. The Thief's Theme, play me at night, they won't act right. Understandable, smooth, then move with. The Thief's Theme, play me at night, they won't act right. Understandable, smooth, then move with. The Thief's Theme, play me at night, they won't act right. Understandable, smooth, then move with. 1, 2. Check 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Check 1, 2, 1, 2. Who got more style than Sundu?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Black Seinfeld. This is the show about absolutely nothing, where we spit that intellectual ignorance in your ear. I go by the name of Psyche.
I go by Bashanissa.
And we have our guest with us in the building, Mr. Gastor El Monte, comedian extraordinaire, podcaster, homie.
That's me.
Before all that. Before we let you continue, we're me and Gio, we're not the biggest fans.
Oh, you're gonna get into that?
Yeah, I have to. Of Nas. Like, once I saw that you picked the song, it's like,
Pick the song.
Okay, once I saw the song was on the list, I was like, all right.
Okay.
So, we're not, like, I love Nas. Great rapper from Queens.
Hope
cool.
Better, though. Just saying.
Better beat selection. That's what we're going to, now we're going to talk about beat selection. I'm going to say, is Nas a better storyteller than rapper?
Good question.
That's a fair question.
I definitely agree with that. He's a great storyteller. One Love, come on, that story was nasty. That story was dope.
His whole first album was all great, kid? Beautiful stories. True. Don't tell me wrong, he can rap.
Wow, that's strong.
I know I can. It's a song of our generation, and the stories that he told in there about the girl who took heroin.
That's our intro to Nas, to be honest, that song.
Yeah, wow. Because I have an older brother, so Hate Me Now was one of my first Nas records that I listened to. And the Hot Boys remix with Missy Elliott and Eve. Yeah. Remember that?
Mine was a bit backwards. It'd be I Can't Tell, then those songs. Because I used to watch BET. It's like, oh, I know this guy. Like, this song's hard.
I might have to say yes to that.
All right.
That is strong.
Yeah, I agree with that.
See, and that's a good hot take.
But I wasn't trying to, like, attack Nas fans. No. I just wanted to.
So this falls into my, like, situation with stand-up. now that you mention that. So as a stand-up, there's like essentially two like main schools of thought. There's like people that do set up punchline humor, and there's people that do stories. Most stand-ups, like even the best storytellers, they don't feel comfortable like kicking a story off with their hours. They usually do set up punchline stuff for like the first 30, 40 minutes, and they'll end with a story. Just because most rooms, they don't go along with a story up front because it takes too much setup time. So you kind of have to earn the right from a room to tell a story. Mm. And like if you're like a real master like Chappelle, he'll start an hour with a story, which is super hard to do, to get a crowd on board with a story like right up front. But yeah, it's almost created a bit of a division. Like you got like a Mitch Hedberg, like full on set up punchline. Whereas you got like I mentioned, a Chappelle, Cosby, like where it's just all story, you know. So I feel like that with MCs, you have like the bars dudes, and you have dudes that do stories. I still think it's rapping. I just think that they fall into two different schools of thought in terms of what they want to tell. But in terms of storytelling, as an MC, yeah, he's incredible at it, for sure.
Okay.
I do think he can do the other stuff. I just don't think he does it often enough. Yeah, that's strong, B. Wow. Word up.
We come here with facts.
I see that.
Yeah. And I'm forever going to be a Hove guy, all right? Ether was amazing.
Yeah.
But Takeover, it was factual, though, okay?
Okay.
One of the best subliminals ever, he said, you know who did you know what with you know who. I'm going to keep that between me and you. Beautiful.
My favorite part about that line is that he made Nas explain it.
Yes!
Like, that's what's so awesome about it. He literally, like, everyone found out what that meant from a Nas interview later.
Exactly.
Like, that's what's so awesome about that. Yeah, that's well done. I commend that.
Shouts out to New York MCs. Are your kids keeping you in tune with the current rap scene, with the little
hippity hop?
With the Lil Pumps and the Lil Xans and Tekashi's?
Not at all. They're 7 and 9. So have a really skewed understanding of what's current right now because of me. So, like, I play, like, a whole bunch of, like, 90s and whatnot. They're like, yo, Lupe and Nas is popping? I'm like, yes, definitely. Go sing that in school, you know?
They're going to flip on you soon.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
They're definitely going to.
But while I can, I'm going to hold it. I feel like if I do it, so, like, every now and then, like, I don't know the names of the songs, but, like, I go to, like, a Dominican party and, like, I'll hear some, like, old joint from the 80s and I'll get, like, a warm, fuzzy feeling of remembering my mom play that around the crib. So I feel like by me doing this, they're going to change taste, but they're going to get those feelings from those songs when they hear it when they're older. Like all these dope rap songs that I'm playing in the car now that like in 5 years they'll probably tease me about. Mm-hmm. In 15 years when they hear them joints on like a old school station, they'll be like, oh, dad used to play this back in the day when he was cleaning or whatever. So that's why I'm doing it. I feel like it'll like connect with them and me.
Oh, that's the difference between my childhood because like the car...
Yeah.
Like, we have, like, the aux cord, and we have, like, Bluetooth. Back then, we only had, like, cassette tapes.
Right, right.
And I don't keep your whole collection in your car, because that's ridiculous. You get robbed real easy.
That's true.
And you don't want to lose that.
And
so,
plus, we relied heavily on Hot 97 to give us most of the new music. And we came up on when hip-hop and R&B were meshing together. Like, Ja Rule was dominating the charts.
And it was the media everywhere. So that's how, like, for me, when I was 7, 8 years old, I knew all the new songs.
Yeah.
That's just me. Because the car, like, it's all about the car play. Whatever's playing in the
car.
That's
true.
I, to this day, have a tape of, in 1999, when Still D.R.E. came out from Dr. Dre's album.
Dre.
Yeah.
Chronic 2001.
Took literally, like, what, 10 years for that to come out between that and the first one?
Yeah.
And Funk Flex, it took him 25 minutes to play through that song.
That sounds like Flex.
I had a whole tape.
How many bombs was he dropping?
It was nuts. He was restarting it. He was like, New York, y'all don't understand what's happening right now. This is a moment. 20. You know how crazy that? That's a whole side of a tape. Like, it's a 60-minute cassette. He took up one whole side on one song. And I kept, like, thinking, like, I def got it on this tape. Nope, he would restart it again. Bombs, replay.
Gotta love Flex,
it was incredible. And it was the right thing to do too. Like,
and he still does it to this very day.
Now it's not right.
Now it's not.
Like, we need it now.
Yeah, there's definitely times that play it.
Just
but
play
that
it.
Was the that was definitely one of the times where I was like, I can't front. This is appropriate. This deserves 25 minutes worth of restarting.
Also, it's like the radio. It's like you got to call your friends, like, yo, check out this song.
Yeah.
And it's still playing by the time everybody's listening to it. Like, 25 minutes is enough to round up all your friends, right?
For sure.
So.
For sure.
I guess it made sense.
There was strategy. Was strategy there. I digged it. Well done, Flex.
Well done. Shouts out to Funk Master Flex. Hopefully we get to have you on one day and we get to talk about just stuff, beefs.
I got another random thing.
What's another random thing?
So how are we going to get the Knicks to tank this season? They keep winning. Stop winning.
Yo, tank. Flex, man.
Tank. Oh, we're not supposed to say tank because we don't get fined like Mark Cuban. Like, it's 100K. It's a lot.
That is true.
That is the most confused franchise I've ever seen.
We did lose
We beat Washington, though.
We lost to Charlotte, though. Even though Trey Burke had 42.
Yo, Trey is balling.
He is balling. I knew Trey would help the team, man. I knew he would.
He was looking a top like 10 Iverson. Pick for a reason.
For sure.
He was Beasley, too. Like, just keep that. Get rid of Moutier. I don't know why they brought him in. What else? Let Frank develop. Yeah. His arms is all the way down to his knees.
I agree with Moutier. Moutier's a bum.
He grew 2 inches since he got drafted. Frank, I'm talking about Frank. They said he's going to go up to 6'10". Keep him.
Jeez.
That's wild.
Oh, yeah. He's 19, right?
Yeah. Like, people
we're
like,
older than basketball players now. Think about that. That's weird.
Yo, think. 2018 draft. People born in the year 2000 are going to get drafted.
What? Like, think, like, 9/11 is now a historical thing. I know there are kids out there now that have not been around for 9/11. Isn't that crazy? We getting old, man.
Yeah. You getting old. I am immortal.
I'm deaf.
All right, Pharrell.
You know?
Well, let's get back to comedy real quick, guys, because I always want to ask comedians this. I always ask, like, homies like Pacheco and them.
Yeah. That's the homie, B.
Shouts out to Pacheco. We're going to have him on soon.
Yeah, man. Gabe's that dude, B.
He is. What was your first experience like when you bombed?
So,
because I know all comedians have bombed at least once.
Yeah, it's awkward. So a few things with that. It's depressing when it happens early, and it happens to everybody. But it keeps happening. That's what most people don't realize.
Mm.
You could be very good. You could be on TV. You could have an hour special. It will happen to you continuously. Until you're so famous that then you have the opposite problem where everything you do gets a cheer because of how famous you are, and then you can't tell if you're good or not. When it happens and it's early on, it's the most demoralizing thing ever. I was married as a comic when I started doing comedy, and I was like an adult. I started later than most comics, and I felt like when I had a bad day, I'd go home, tell my wife. I still had a good day at work. Life was fine, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I can't think of, like, if you're like 19, like, you're still not even like established as yourself yet in a lot of cases. You have a bad show. You're not legally allowed to drink, but you got through at a bar. So, like, they'll give you a drink. So you're at a place that serves alcohol. You perform terribly. None of the other comics are going to talk to you if you perform terribly. And you're in a bar.
That's how it's like?
Yeah, because realistically, if you're at an open mic, like you're first starting, you're checking to see if your stuff is good enough and hoping someone sees you to put you at a bar show and then eventually clubs.
Mm.
So you're in front of 25 comics. So as is, tough room because no one's even looking at you. They're just working on their own stuff.
Of course.
And then if you do bad in that room and your stuff sucks, no one's going to come talk to you. They're going to talk to the other comics that did well, try to network and get on shows. So if you do bad, no one talks to you. And then you're alone at a bar wondering what went wrong. And imagine if you worked hard at that. Like, yo, I spent like 5 hours writing jokes this week. I went to 12 mics and I bombed at all of them. And you're alone at a bar with that. And no one's with you. Like, there's no one with you in life yet. Like, you don't have a partner to talk to. You can't really tell your parents. They probably ain't really into the idea yet. It's depressing.
It sounds depressing,
yeah, for
man.
Sure. And then if you get through that, it's dope. Because then at that point, you get pretty good. But it keeps happening. It's just that what you consider a bomb changes. Like, right now, I'll never have a set, thankfully, and knock on wood, I hope it doesn't happen now. But I don't have sets anymore that are like, horrific. Like, it just doesn't happen. I've done too much work at this point. I have too much material. I'm able to adapt, so I could like call plays where if it's going bad, I could still fix it to where it's okay, and the crowd will think it's fine, but I'll consider it a bomb because I know I didn't do what I normally do, and I'll use that as a learning experience. But that level of bombing would have been like a 8 out of 10 when I first started, and then there's gonna come a point, hopefully, where like, it doesn't happen to most people, but to like 100 comics out there, they got the opposite problem. Like, if you're, you know, if you're like Chris Rock, if you're Dave Chappelle, you know how hard it is to figure out if you're good, if the material works, because now anywhere they go, people are just excited. There's euphoria. Like, oh my God, this is, it's Chris Rock.
He's alive. He's here. He exists. You
know? Because when I go to try material, all I do is the same things. I go to a room I've never been to or a room that I rarely go to, and I make sure that they don't say Gas Store from Comedy Central so that I get like a real reaction. There's no expectations. And if I still get laughs after doing that 10 times, I know the joke works. They have nowhere they could go that it's a secret. Like, everyone knows. If you're at a comedy club, you probably know Chris Rock. You probably know Dave Chappelle. So anytime they go in the room, people are just laughing because it's them. Like, how hard would it be to not laugh if Dave Chappelle was talking? Now, even when he's talking serious, like, he literally has to say, yo, but seriously for a second. For people to, like, understand,
like, oh, this isn't a joke. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to be funny here.
Yeah. So it's such a challenge for them dudes to, like, have a real read. And the only time they know it sucks is after they've put it out. Like, after they've put out the special and people could judge it in their house when it's too late. So they don't have the same ability that we have to, like, work material at bad clubs to figure out if something works or work a material at a good club as an unknown. So it's an interesting, like, process. But, yeah, it def sucks. You def don't want to go through it, but you have to in order to figure out if you're good or not. And if you aren't willing to do that, you won't make it.
Another thing that a lot of comedians go through, too, is heckling.
Yeah.
Have you ever been heckled?
Every comic has, and it's fun, being frank. It's some of my favorite stuff. The only times I don't want it is if I'm recording, like if I'm doing like a video for like a TV shoot, or like in August I'm going to be taping my album. That'll be a day I don't want it, you know? But
what's like one of the best clapbacks you ever got from a heckle? and you just had to let them like eat. They're like, okay, you got it.
It's just about reacting to what they say and saying it back loud enough to the crowd so that they know what you're saying. And then when you can say anything you want from there. The mistake that most comics make is that they instantly snap back. And that's funny, but it's only funny to you. The problem is you're the only one with a mic. Mm-hmm. So no one heard what they said, you know? So if someone calls you a jerk or they make a wisecrack, you heard it, but the 100 people in the room didn't hear it. So when you clap back, if you didn't repeat what they said to you first, then you look like a jerk, like you're just picking a fight with somebody. You know what I mean? So.
Oh, okay. See, you know what I mean? So something like you're a jerk, like, oh, I'm a jerk?
Right. You always have to repeat it so that the crowd's on your side. Because they're on your side initially. You don't want to lose that. Exactly. So, like, I've seen somebody clap back at somebody in the wheelchair. You know, I heard the joke. I thought it was funny, but I was literally backstage. I could see the whole interaction and I saw the crowd turn. But I remember the comic didn't acknowledge the whole fact that the guy said it first and didn't acknowledge the guy was in the wheelchair until after he said the joke. So, yeah, you gotta definitely make the crowd aware that you're being clapped at first.
So, like, that's great ways to transition to my question, where it's like nowadays, artists and even comedians have to be more careful in what they have to say. You don't want to like pass this problematic light.
That's why I have him with me. So because he's the PC one.
Like, don't
he's
get me wrong.
He's my sensor.
Don't get me wrong. Dave Chappelle is great, but he said a lot of problematic things, statements in his special.
No, he doesn't.
He did. Anyways, for you as a comic, do you have to like
when PC
you,
yourself?
PC yourself. Yeah, basically.
I don't.
You gotta hold your tongue, B. Let me stop.
I feel like I say everything that I want to say. I don't think that I've had as many times as Dave Chappelle has had in terms of saying something that I think would cause an uproar. I've def said stuff by accident that I felt like sounded like something grimy, and I had to correct it on stage. But in terms of intentionally like being PC. There's stuff that I feel like if it's true to me, I'm really not concerned with the PC aspect of it.
Okay.
I make an effort to do it in rooms that don't record first, because this is the challenge, right? Like, I have a funny thought. I know it's going to be funny at some point. I don't know how to make it funny instantly. I have to work that out. And the first 10 times I try it, I'm going to say something that's not PC and it's not funny until I get it to be funny. So if I'm doing that in the place that's recording it, that's going to look bad to whoever plays it out of context, because you didn't give me a chance to make it funny yet. And that's kind of the challenge right now with PC world. You got people like, because of their phone, they have access to record everything perfectly.
True.
When I didn't get a chance to make it funny yet. So I'm in like a show that's low stakes. I'm trying to work on jokes that I know push buttons. That's the whole point. I'm trying to talk about stuff that is dark, kind of like we talked about earlier. This is like, you know, stuff that I find that bothers me, stuff that might have depressed me. These are dark topics.
I feel like it's a comedian's job to do that, though, right, to push exactly. buttons. Like with Chappelle, how old is 15 really?
Right.
If he did that today, that would be a hot topic.
Yeah, yeah. Right. That's interesting.
Yeah. But keep in mind, like, that was funny, whereas it probably wasn't funny day one. You know what I mean? He had to work that joke at smaller rooms to get it funny. So there's times he said that where that joke might have landed awkwardly, you know? And if there was camera phones back then, that would have blown up in a whole, like, negative way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's why most comedians are trying to ban phones. Like, they have the technology to put your phone in the
bin.
What's it called, bin?
Yeah. Nah, they probably have some sort of, like,
a it's a
cubby
case.
Or whatever.
It's a case.
Cubby case.
Yeah, you put it in your pocket, and the only way to open it is to get to leave the
right.
stage.
Right, Rock it's and Chappelle small. Do that.
Yeah. I think, like, smaller clubs might need to do that, or you don't want to do that to your customers.
Yeah, it's a catch-22. Like, we're just not big enough to kind of have that kind of demand. Essentially, you kind of just have to check them with it early on into a set. Ideally, find somebody that's on a phone and check them hard enough to let them know that, yo, that's not cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of cleans up from there. And most people are aware of that what you're doing is a performance, and that there's a certain level of you came here to see this.
True.
So your expectations should be different. Like, if I went to your house and I started saying stuff that you didn't agree with, that's different. But you came to the comedy club to hear my opinions, and what I say might not jive with you, but just understand you made that choice. You came here. Now, if I'm, like, bombarding you and I'm following you at your job saying stuff that's not PC, by all means, get tight.
Yeah,
but it's different, you know. Like, whether you're watching it on TV and you make that choice to click play, or you came to the club to see me, understand that comes with the understanding that I'm gonna say what I need to say.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's every comedian's job right now to have some sort of hot take, because I love when a comedian can give me a different perspective that I didn't agree with first, but now I can understand where they're coming from.
Right.
That's why I'm a big fan of Gerard Carmichael.
Oh, for sure.
Because
for sure.
Like, the way he starts his hot take, it just starts immediately. Then he'll explain it.
Yeah.
Then by the time he's done explaining, like, oh, yeah, I see your point.
What slept on, you saw his last special, 8?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bo Burnham.
Yeah.
That's his directing.
That's what I've been trying to tell everybody, because Bo also directed Chris Rock's.
Y'all.
Yep. And he's on point.
His
the music,
is incredible.
The way it started, just him quiet, looking up. Like, that was just amazing to me.
Yeah, and just like little things, like Chris Rock, big star, he put him in an environment where you got to see him walk out and kind of be larger than life in this small room. And then Gerard, to your point, super introspective.
So, cynical.
Yeah, so he didn't even start him on the intro. He started him mid-thought.
Yeah.
And ended him mid-thought.
Yeah, that's
like,
what I mean.
He wants you in the cycle of this guy's constantly thinking. Such a brilliant director.
Even the music, too, was nice. And so, it's one of my favorite specials.
No, really well done.
All right, so that was Black Seinfeld.
Show about absolutely nothing.
Our special guest.
Gastor Almonte.
Word up. Thanks for having me, folks.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Oh, give the people your contact information.
Oh, for sure. You can find
social
me
medias.
GastorAlmonte.com for all my dates. And you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at GastorAlmonte, GastorAlmonte.
Tell them about the podcast real quick, too.
Oh, come through. You'll hear it. Stoops to Stages. I interview a whole bunch of dope people. And in August, come out to my taping. It should be taking place soon. You'll see the exacts and locations on the site.
Well, thank you guys for tuning in to Black Seinfeld, y'all. We'll see you guys again next week. Until then, peace.
Peace.